Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
What are you doing this Lent? The St. Paul Center is streaming their newest video Bible study for free, starting Ash Wednesday. Based on Scott Hahn's renowned covenantal theology, this is a study no one should miss. Invite your friends, Catholic or not. Don't miss your chance to see this premium study for free. Go to stpaulcenter.com to sign up today. With CMF Curo, you don't have to compromise your faith to get great health care. Finally, there is a pro-life option that respects and engages your Catholic faith with a community that supports you in living health care fully alive. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast.
Hello and welcoming. This is Lavinia Spirita with Mary Lou Nemechek, and we're going to keep on looking at the Gospel of Mark for the next couple of shows. The next couple of shows have to do with the entrance of Jesus in Jerusalem. And we're going to go to chapter 10, verse 32. We left Jesus and the disciples with a number of stories that Jesus is telling from the way to Galilee to Judea. Now, if you know anything about the Holy Land, you know that Galilee is in the north, Samaria is in the middle, and Judea is in the south. So for Jesus to be walking all the way to Jerusalem, which is in the south, from Capernaum, which is all the way in the north, it would have taken quite a long time, probably a couple, 2 or 3 days, maybe even more than that, even though it's just only a two-hour bus ride. In today's parlance, right? You take a bus ride, you kind of skim the Jordan River, you take that road all the way down. However, in Jesus's time, it's a little more complicated. And so on the way, he tells a number of stories, and he ends his stories with telling Peter that, "I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive 100-fold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions and in the age to come eternal life. But many that are first will be last and the last first." So that's one of those things that we grew up hearing Jesus say, right? And we're like, oh, yeah, right, yeah. So, but in the end, what does that mean? And specifically, what do you think, Mary Lou, did that mean to the people of the time listening to Jesus?
Well, I'm not sure that they got it at all in terms of the first shall be last and the last shall be first. You know, clearly they were thinking of it in a, I would say, more of a military conquering type of scenario. And that, you know, if you're sitting at the right and the left of the person in charge, the king or whoever, you were certainly sitting in authority over others. And I think that they were kind of looking for that that glory and privilege and control, perhaps, sovereignty over others.
So it's that pagan ideal of lording it over others, right? The thing that even today we think about when we think about people in power. And yet the ideal that Jesus proposes for his church is that of servant leadership. So if you would be the leader, you need to serve, you need to be ready to serve and to wash the feet of those who are following you. And so that's kind of what's going on here. Many. And remember this, remember that Jesus reproves the Pharisees, because he says, woe to you, Pharisees, because you want the first place in the synagogues, right? And he's always talking about, like, if you go to the table, to the banquet, and you sit, remember they were like, you right. sit by order of precedence. So if you in this banquet, you put yourself in a place of importance, and then you're asked to move to make room for somebody who's more important than you, what do you think you're going to be feeling? I mean, it's not going to go well with you. And there's that idea of making ourselves small and making ourselves the servants of all, instead of focusing in on, oh, Jesus, when you come into your power, that's what James and John want to ask, right? When you come into your power, can we have the palace on your right and the palace on your left? And can we have the Ministry of Transportation and the Ministry of Commerce? Or, I mean, they're thinking in very sort of secular terms, right?
Right. And they posed that question as quickly as they could, you know, before the other disciples could pose it.
And they're indignant, but it says that the other disciples were indignant, probably because they meant to ask the same questions,
exactly.
right?
Just
and James and John got a jump on him, right?
Yep, they did.
So, yeah, that's kind of one of those situations that Mark puts in the gospel, which goes to the principle of reliability, because it's a statement against interest. In the law, there are some exceptions to the hearsay rule, and which is repeating what somebody said as opposed to first-hand testimony. And one of the exceptions is a statement against interest. So if I, talk about it in court and I testify that I did something silly or stupid or dishonest, and yet I still talk about it, I'm not doing it for my own interest. I'm doing it against my interest, but I'm doing it to show the truth of another thing, right? Mm-hmm. And in this case, Mark is showing the abject failure of all the disciples to even understand what Jesus was all about, which goes against people saying, oh, the Gospels were written afterwards as puff pieces for Jesus and for the disciples, and the church, the Catholic Church, wasn't even made up until, wasn't even created, quote unquote, until the Council of Nicaea and, you know, all that silliness, right? And yet, right. If you were about the business of creating a con, basically, conning people into how great you are, you wouldn't be including stuff like this.
Exactly.
You wouldn't be including that you were squabbling, basically, for who gets to sit shotgun, right? Who gets to sit
right.
up front?
I mean, I say if the kids would always call shotgun
right?
car.
Shotgun.
Yep.
They're like me. No, I'm. You know, they have these great fights as to who can sit up front, right?
Yeah.
And that reminds me. This attitude of the disciples reminds me of my children fighting as to who could sit up front. You know, which means what? It's totally silly and unimportant.
It reminds me when they're fighting over dessert and who's going to get the bigger piece. You have the one that complains, cut it, and then the other one pick which piece they want. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one's in complete control, and it humbles them slightly. But everybody's out for that bigger piece, right?
Right. And that's what Jesus says. The many that are first will be last, and the last first. So the Pharisees who saw the first place, sought the first places in the synagogues and at the banquets, are probably at the forefront of Jesus's mind. Okay. So verse 32 of chapter 10 of Mark, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. Now remember that they have come down in a certain way, if you're looking at the map, with Galilee in the north and Judea in the south. Technically, we would usually say when we look at a map that somebody was coming down from Galilee, right? But instead, everyone always knows that you would go up to Jerusalem, because especially as you and I have seen, having been there personally, Jerusalem is a good 3,200 feet above sea level. And so it's quite tall, and it seems even more when you approach on the Jerusalem road, because Jericho is between 900 and 1,000 feet below sea level. So right. It makes the trek seem even more. But in any case, most people, when they spoke about going to Jerusalem, they don't always say going up to Jerusalem, because there was always a significant climb about going to Jerusalem. And he says they were going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed him were afraid. Why were they afraid? Because he gives, at this point in verse 33, the most comprehensive prediction of his passion yet. And we know that the disciples do not take Jesus' predictions of the pastor very well, because they don't want to hear that kind of stuff, right? They only want to hear the stuff about the palaces and the horses and Jesus, I will sit at your right and your left, but they don't want to hear about the suffering part. But this is what he says. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. As usual, the disciples are stuck on the first part, right?
Right.
They're stuck on everything he says up until and kill him. And it's almost like they don't hear and after 3 days he will rise, because it's just not part of their mindset, of their vocabulary, of their worldview, the possibility of a resurrection. Even though Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead in front of the apostles and raised other people from the dead, this possibility of Jesus himself rising is so far away from the disciples' imagination and what seems possible or even what God can do, that they just discount it. And they just are afraid when he keeps talking about that. And you have, at this point, imagine this is from the sublime to the ridiculous. You have Jesus announcing his passion, the disciples freaking out, and then James and John in a complete non sequitur in verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward and asked him, "Teacher, we want you to do whatever we ask of you." And he says, "What do you want?" And they say, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left." So this is what we were talking about beforehand, right? They want to sit up front. They want to sit up front in the passenger seat with the grown-ups. I mean, if you want to put it in childish way. They still don't understand what Jesus is talking about when he talks about the passion. But Jesus significantly answers him, saying, "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" So remember that drinking a cup and being baptized were always symbols of absorbing something or participating in something all the way to the dregs. So if you drain a cup, you drink it all the way down. And if you are baptized, it means you are saturated, immersed, fully plunged, dipped into whatever it is. And in this case, it's blood. It's suffering, right? And they say, clueless, where they say, "We are able." No, they're not. They don't know that. And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. I wouldn't have wanted to be James and John at that point.
Right.
Making our way to Jericho, because they haven't quite made it up the road to Jerusalem yet, right?
You know, going back, using that word cup in the Old Testament is either a blessing or wrath. It was either something wonderful or something horrible. And it was viewed as a judgment. So I'm sure that was confusing to the disciples as well when they think about the cup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, and then he says, before we talk about Jericho, he says that the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests. And then he says, verse 45, "For the Son of Man also came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So today, when we think about ransom, we think about, you know, somebody's billionaire son being kidnapped and, you know, the kidnappers want a ransom, right?
Right.
But in the old days, the word ransom connoted slavery. It connoted people being bought from slavery, or maybe sold into slavery. And It was very interesting. It meant literally, the Greek word litron means the buying of a prisoner's freedom. And actually, the Old Testament in Leviticus 25 has a whole set of rules, of laws, about if your relative ends up in slavery, you have an obligation to go buy him out, to buy his freedom, to become his kinsman redeemer, which is a term, a goel, which we see in the Old Testament. Boaz in the book of Ruth, if you'll recall that romantic story, it's really not that romantic, because Boaz has the has actually the duty of the kinsman redeemer. He has to do something for Ruth. He probably does have to marry her, even though there was somebody who had a prior precedence, but that person with the precedence, you know, who has a higher right to Ruth, yields it to Boaz, if you remember the story. But there's this picture of the kinsman redeemer, of the one who will come in and who will redeem you. Isaiah speaks about the redeemer in Exodus. Moses speaks about the Holy One of Israel is your redeemer. Deuteronomy 7, again, is a picture of the kinsman redeemer. And 1 Peter 1:18, Peter himself says, you know that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your ancestors with the precious blood of Christ. So, and then if you're a geek like me and you think about C.S. Lewis, C.S. Lewis wrote many things, of course, The Chronicles of Narnia, Mere Christianity, Surprised by Joy, The Weight of Glory, all these books. But he also wrote a science fiction trilogy. And in the, I think it's, in all three books of the science fiction trilogy, so Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength, so those are the names of the three books, which I highly recommend if you ever have a chance to read them. The hero there, his name is Ransom.
Oh, really?
Elwyn Ransom.
Interesting.
And so Ransom is, in a certain way, a Christ figure. Because if you know C.S. Lewis, there's always a Christ figure somewhere, right? In Narnia, it's Aslan, the lion, who's the Christ figure. And in the space trilogy, it's Elwyn Ransom. And that English word ransom has always struck me when I see it in the scriptures, because it kind of recalls to me how C.S. Lewis named his main hero in the space trilogy Ransom as a type of Christ. So I think that's pretty interesting. Now, they arrived to Jericho, right? Remember, in order to go to Jerusalem, if you look at the map, you kind of have to come to Jericho first and wind your way up all the way to Jerusalem. And also, if you took the road in from Jericho, so from 900 to 1,000 feet below sea level, all the way up to 3,200 feet above sea level, you are actually, you're going up a road with switchbacks. It's a very dangerous road at the time. If you remember Luke's parable of the Good Samaritan, it takes place on this very dangerous road because it was very steep and you couldn't see around the corner. So bandits and, that kind of thieves would hide out and prey on the hapless travelers. And that's the whole story of the Good Samaritan, because the poor guy who's going probably up to Jerusalem or down from Jerusalem to Jericho is taken upon by robbers and beaten to, bloody, and his things are stolen, and the Good Samaritan comes by and dresses his wounds, so he's a picture of Christ, etc. So this road that went from Jerusalem to Jericho, from Jericho to Jerusalem, was, again, a very famous one that approached Jerusalem from the east. And so we'll see, probably in the next show, the significance of Jesus approaching Jerusalem from the east, because the Messiah in the Old Testament always approached Jerusalem from the east. As a matter of fact, in the Kidron Valley in Jerusalem, which you have seen as well, there are many, many tombs. There are tombs of Jews who say, even Jews from America, from other places, who save up money in order to buy a plot in the Kidron Valley so that they will be the first ones to greet the Messiah when he arrives from the east.
That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
And there's plenty to this day. There's people who get buried there because the Messiah is coming in from the east, right? Never mind that he's already come, okay? But that's a different story. So what about Jericho? I thought Jericho is also a fascinating, fascinating city, because it is, in fact, one of the oldest inhabited cities in the world, on Earth, right?
Right. Goes back over 8,000 years.
That's right. And it's right there by the Jordan, and it's today it's about 25,000 people. The name, the Canaanite word Jericho, meant moon or month. And the original settlement, built on freshwater spring and abandoned in antiquity, dates back to the Neolithic, around 9,000 BC. So that's 11,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Unbelievable. But it's, you know, the little bit that we saw of it when we were there, it wasn't that, it's not that eye appealing, let me put it that way.
No, it was a bunch of casinos, remember? It was like, it's Palestinian, it's in the West Bank right now.
It's all Palestinian. And,
it's kind of messy, unfortunately, like a lot of the Palestinian settlements are.
Yeah.
It wasn't really much to look at. Remember how they tried to get us to take photos of the sycamore tree? They said, this is the sycamore tree.
Yeah.
Where Zacchaeus climbed out? No, probably not, you know?
No, I doubt it. So
if it were an olive.
There's a buck to be made by all of that, right?
I know, right? But what I thought was interesting is this is truly a very ancient place. The whole area of Jericho has the ancient Neolithic settlement. Then you have the one that came afterwards. Then you have the one that came after. Then they started building over. And then they go, it's like stratified. So if you go down, that's basically what they found so far. Because they could go deeper and find evidence of more early settlement.
And you know, when you travel either down to Jericho or up to Jerusalem, your ears will pop because of the elevation and everything. So it's you really have a sense of how low you are at Jericho and how high you are when you reach Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, it's like 4,000 feet.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing, you know. From Jerusalem, okay, and then another thing about Jerusalem, if you'll recall, is that, Jericho, is that remember when we went to the Mount of Temptations in the wilderness?
Mm-hmm.
You go through Jericho. So actually the site of the Mount of Temptations, of Jesus' temptation, is right at just all the way down from Jerusalem through Jericho, and then you go to the Mount, to the wilderness. It's not that far away.
Right.
So Jesus could have approached the wilderness, you know, the Mount of Temptations, fairly quickly, right? If he was approaching it from Jerusalem. So I thought that was interesting too. A number of ancient populations claimed Jerusalem. You had the Amorites and the Hyksos and the Canaanites. And then, of course, what happened in 1300 BC? Well, Joshua happened, right? And they came in, and there was a famous conquest of Canaan. And we have the famous demolition of the walls of the city of Jericho by Joshua's trumpets. Mm-hmm. In 331, it was captured by Alexander the Great. And Herod relocated a new settlement nearby. And unfortunately, Jericho was destroyed by Titus and the Romans in 68 AD. About the same time that Jerusalem was destroyed. In 1994, it was one of the first places on the West Bank to come under the newly constituted Palestinian Authority. Just to kind of put it in context, I think that's important to know a little bit more about Jerusalem. When we come back next time, we're going to talk about the dramatic story of Bartimaeus, the man who was blind, who Jesus restores to perfect sight, and at the same time also restoring the sight, the spiritual blindness of his disciples as well. Thank you for joining us.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.
CMF Curo is the country's first Catholic healthcare ministry to provide an affordable health sharing solution rooted in Catholic teaching and community. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast. That's mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast.